I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is Radio Boston.
I am sorry for the lives I have taken and for the suffering I have caused and for the damage I have done.
The words of Jahar Tsarnaev, the convicted Boston Marathon bomber who apologized today to the victims and survivors of the attacks of April 2013.
Tsarnaev delivered a brief statement in federal court today after listening to a series of victim impact statements, which included deep expressions of pain, loss, and anger from the victims and their family members.
Then, as expected, federal judge George O'Toole formally imposed the death penalty on Tsarnaev. The sentence comes more than a month after a federal jury delivered its death penalty verdict for Tsarnaev's role in the bombing attack and its aftermath that killed four people and injured more than 260. Joining us here in the studio is Donald Stern. He's the former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts and now managing director of Affiliated Monitors. Donald Stern, good to have you.
Thank you.
Also with us is Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and currently a professor at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, welcome back to you.
Good to be here.
So I guess the big surprise, which broke late this afternoon, was this statement by Tsarnaev. No one knew for sure that he was going to deliver it. Nancy Gertner, to you first. What did you make of it?
Well, first of all, I was not surprised. I was not surprised because the sentencing statement of a defendant is sort of the last moment in the process that he can be heard. And while it obviously, it was clear it was not a statement that could make a difference to the court, it was important, it seems to me, to the defense to humanize him, even to provide, even for the atmospherics going forward, even for an appellate review. So this is not just a cartoon figure. This is someone who said something. For the defendant, sometimes it's critical that he speak for himself. Mm. If the appeals are not successful, then this will have been his last moment on the stage. And there's a difference between speaking now and speaking during the trial.
See, this is my question, because he remained absolutely impassive and quiet throughout the whole trial, including the sentencing phase. Why wouldn't he have spoken during the trial?
Because were he to speak in those occasions, he would have been cross-examined. Mm-hmm. This is an occasion to speak in a narrative way, to speak without being challenged, to speak more freely. So, and while people say, you know, it doesn't make a difference, he's going to get the death penalty anyhow, for a court of appeals looking at this case, candidly, even looking at dry antiseptic legal issues, it makes a difference when you're looking at them in terms of a victim, in terms of a defendant that you looks as a cartoon character, or a defendant whom you see as a man.
Well, Donald Stern, I mean, some of the other things that Tsarnaev said, he said that he learned about the victims, their names, their souls during the course of the trial. He said, "No soul is burdened with more than it can bear." And then he also said, "I pray to Allah to bestow his mercy on those affected in the bombing and their families. I pray for your healing." I mean, just to sort of piggyback off what Nancy was saying, what difference could this make now?
I'm not sure it does make a difference, and I guess I disagree with Nancy. I'm not sure it's going to have much of an effect on the appeals court. Sure, it humanizes him to some extent, but my reaction when, and of course we don't have the full statement. We're relying upon media tweets that are coming from the courtroom, so none of us have the full statement. But based upon what I've read, it strikes me as too little too late. And I have the same question, frankly, that Anthony raised, which is, if he was going to make a statement even coming close to this, why not? What did he have to lose to making a statement, even if he opened himself to cross-examination? Why not make it when it mattered, before the jury rendered his verdict? I have to confess, I've got a little bit of skepticism that he's really apologizing for the crime. He's apologizing for the harm caused to the victims.
Describe that distinction. I know, because before we went on the air, you made that distinction. I'd love you to sort of just
A little bit. It's sort of out of my expertise, but I do know that there are some jihadists that take the view that that they are sorry for civilian damage, for collateral damage, but not sorry for planting the bomb, not sorry for wearing the vest that blows people up, because they view that there's a higher calling, there's a higher reason for doing it. I don't know that that's what was in his mind. All I'm saying is that that may explain why he didn't want to be cross-examined about this, because maybe, because on cross-examination, the prosecutor was said, "Are you sorry for planting the bomb? Are you sorry for being a participant in this crime with your brother?" And if the answer to that is no, "I'm not sorry," than the other feelings of sorry and mercy and we worry about your soul may not have gone over so well with the jury.
Nancy, do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think I don't know if the portrait of him that has been drawn by the press of a jihadist is an accurate portrait. And to some degree, there is so much about this case that we don't know. The docket in the case, the public docket in the case, is three-quarters sealed. The press hasn't reported that. So to some degree, here's a narrative that Judy Clark could be doing, which is, here's what he said, and here's what he wanted to say, and here's what we wanted to do throughout the trial, but we were barred from doing it, barred during the jury trial, the liability phase, from talking about the relationship with the brother, because that was a sentencing issue, barred from doing I don't know what else, that skewed the portrait of Tsarnaev that came out at trial. And this is her beginning to try to show that.
But I'm sorry if we keep circling around this, but to what end? I mean, according to the tweets that were coming from reporters in the courtroom, he Jahar Tsarnaev himself today said, in case there's, just to clear up any last confusion, I did it. He said that. So, I mean, to what end does this fulfilling of a portrait bring us when...
Well, the issue is...
He put the bomb down.
But the issue has never been liability. The issue has never been who did it. Judy Clark said that at the outset. The issue has only been death penalty. And, you know, as a judge, you were not supposed to be swayed by your sense of context. But you obviously are. And the sense of context is not just the victim's pain on the one hand, which was palpable, but also the view of the defendant as a monster. So, yes, you want to show that he has done monstrous things, but it is a more complicated picture than either was shown or she was allowed to show. Of course that matters. It's the reason why the government, you know, had 30 victim impact statements today, even when the outcome was a foregone conclusion. Because the optics, the atmospherics, your sense of the three-dimensional nature of all the people here, of course matter. Mm. And I would never, if I were representing him, for example, I would certainly have suggested that he should speak if he could. And the judge had to give him that opportunity. That's part of the law.
Right.
And we should talk about those victim impact statements. In a moment, we're going to be hearing from David Boeri, who's at federal court, the federal courthouse in South Boston. But listeners, if you're just joining us, a federal judge has formally sentenced Jahar Tsarnaev to death for his role in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. Tsarnaev apologized to the victims and the victims' family. Here's some of what he said as reported by the Boston Globe. I would like to apologize to the victims and the survivors. I did do it. I am sorry for the lives I have taken, for the suffering I have caused, and for the terrible damage I have done. I am Muslim. My religion is Islam. I pray to Allah to bestow his mercy on those affected in the bombing and their families. I pray for your healing. That's some of what was said just moments ago in federal court by Jahar Tsarnaev. So, Donald Stern, what happens next? We've talked a lot about how, even though this is the formal sentencing of Tsarnaev to the penalty of death, it doesn't end here, right?
No, there'll be appeals. You know, one of the issues that came up really at during the hearing today was where would the place of execution be? Mm-hmm. Judy Clark, his lawyer, asked that it be in New Hampshire, and my memory is that the federal judge has the authority and the discretion to pick the place of execution in a death penalty case. In a state such as Massachusetts, which has no death penalty, the judge can pick another state. Here he picked Indiana, which is the sort of the death row for federal inmates. And I don't know what the number is now, but they're probably over 100 plus inmates on federal death row in Indiana. And there have only been, I think, four or five in the last decade that have actually been executed.
Two in the last decade.
Okay.
Two. Right.
So, you know, there'll be a long series of appeals, and the Court of Appeals, at least the Court of Appeals, will take a close look at the hearing and at the trial to make sure that he got a fair trial.
Mm. Well, listeners, we want to know what you think now that we've reached this formal stage of the trial where Judge O'Toole has formally given Jahar Tsarnaev the death penalty. He said, I hereby sentence you to death by execution. Also that we heard Jahar Tsarnaev make a some form of an apology today. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with your reactions. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. But let's now go to Mokley Federal Courthouse, where WBUR senior reporter David Boeri joins us. David, can you hear me?
I can, Magda.
Hi, David. So first of all, tell us what the reaction was in the courtroom as Jahar Tsarnaev spoke. What was that like?
The room was tense. People were straining to hear. He spoke rather quietly. For us in the courtroom, his back was turned. He seemed somewhat emotional, but we strained at all the words. And, you know, we did manage to make out what he said, but it was pretty clear. This was something, you know, there were very few surprises today. This was one of the few questions that we had, whether he would speak or not. We knew what was to come, what we were going to hear in terms of victim impact statements. There was no suspense. The judge essentially was imposing the sentence that somebody else, the jurors, had formed that he couldn't change. But this was what we found.
Right.
And Tsarnaev got up and he did say, you know, I begin in the name of Allah. And then he talked and quoted Allah. He said, I would like now to apologize to the victims and the survivors. And he said, in fact, I am guilty. Immediately after the bombings that I did, I learned their names, faces, their ages. And throughout this trial, I found the names and the victims' names and the ages, and they had burdened souls. He then said, I am sorry for the lives I've taken, for the suffering I've caused, for the damage I've done. I'm a Muslim. I pray to Allah to bestow his mercy upon the deceased. I pray for your relief, for your healing, for your well-being and your struggle, and I ask Allah to have mercy on me, my brother, and my family. He paused a couple of times to gain his composure. Yes.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I mean, were you able to see family members or victims in the courtroom as Tsarnaev was reading his statement? How did they react?
There was not a lot of reaction to it. They were tuned into it, to be sure. The jurors, and this is what was rather odd today, but the jurors were back, almost all the jurors who had convicted him and sentenced him to the death penalty were in the jury box, and they were watching the proceedings. There was not a lot of reaction to it. There was certainly not a lot of what people who appeared to be impressed or moved by what he said.
David, I'm curious about that. I want to get to the victim impact statements, too, because I know the day was full of those. But what did you make? Why was the jury back? And maybe this is a question for you, Judge Gerdes.
Well, no, this is the discretion. Of course, you know, judges often tell jurors this is a participatory process. This is the American justice system. It's based on the participation, the willingness of people to serve, and they're doing their best to listen to the arguments, to evaluate all. So it's common for judges to invite jurors back.
But it's rare for the jurors to come back.
Yeah. So what do you make of that, Nancy?
That's right.
Well, I mean, I am troubled by a verdict on death that was as quick as this one was. I am troubled by the jury selection, and as I've mentioned before, I'm troubled by the change of venue. So the question is whether this is, as David described it, jurors who simply wanted to see the proceeding that they had been a part of, or whether this is jurors who had somehow felt invested in the outcome, which would be very troubling.
Hmm. Listeners,
that's interesting. You know, that's it.
Yeah, go ahead, David. I just want to reset this for our listeners who might just be joining us. If you are just joining us, a federal judge has formally sentenced Jahar Tsarnaev to death for his role in 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. We also heard an apology of sorts from Jahar Tsarnaev today, and we're joined by WBUR senior reporter David Boeri, former U.S. Attorney Donald Stern, and former federal judge Nancy Gertner. David, go ahead. You were saying.
So what was striking is that they were invited to sit in the box, in the jurors' box, where they had been. And so what you have, and you know, recognize that the people who chose to make impact statements chose themselves here. They were self-selecting. What we haven't seen are the people who didn't come. And, you know, what is going on? There's a division underneath all this that's not been talked about. It wasn't talked about today. And that is the deep division, the fact that a number of victims had approached the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Attorney General of the United States saying, stop this. We don't want you to seek capital punishment. By the way, it's not their choice as to whether it happens or not. The government rejected it. Judy Clark, the defense attorney for Tsarnaev, pointed out in court that he was willing. He had offered a plea. The deal that the government had been offered, he would plead guilty. He would forego any appeals. He would go to prison, life in prison without a chance of parole, and he would also cooperate and help them to talk about how people become radicalized like he did. So there was that on the board. There's this division underneath, but here on the surface, and this I understand the Judge Gertner is troubled by, you have people who have been up, who today, some of the victims congratulated the jury, thanked them for the job, which is to say, and also thanked them for the verdict they got, and they are speaking to them. And so you see that it's perhaps we're being presented with a kind of a vision of consent that everybody was on board. This was the death penalty. It was meant to be. The victims all wanted it. And there's what the process brought us. In fact, there's a concern about manufactured consent, but it is what it is. They were in the box. Afterwards, Judy Clark asked the judge. She wanted to make a note of all the jurors by, if not name, because they haven't been identified, by number as to who was there, just for the purposes of future appeals, perhaps.
Well, David, if we may, let's take a step back, because the majority of the day in court today was those victim impact statements that you mentioned earlier. Was there a common theme amongst what people wanted to say to the court and to Tsarnaev?
Often with impact statements, and certainly here with these impact statements today, we saw a mix of emotions. There's anger, sorrow, resentment, despair, hope. And, you know, as we've talked about before, the fact of the matter is this sentence was a done deal. And so all we had was basically the judge was going to impose formally what had been done, what he couldn't change. And so, therefore, the original intent of victim impact statements, which is to provide information to the judge before he forms a sentence, is foregone. That's already been done. So what you have on display instead are the other rationales for giving victim impact statements. Therapy, talking, gaining strength by telling the public about, you know, a jury, an audience, about your victimization, and also the expression of anger. And we saw that. And we saw that in pretty graphic terms at case, pretty raw terms.
Such as who?
The Campbell.
And I'm sorry.
Well, the Campbell family. Yeah. The family, Crystal Campbell's mother and father spoke. The mother said, you know, I know life is hard, but the choices you made were despicable. What you did to my daughter was despicable. And there are others who damned them. Karen McWaters, a friend of Crystal Campbell, said, you know, she was not the enemy. You made her the enemy. And it went on. There were, I'm just going through my notes here, the Collier family spoke. And here, the sister of Sean Collier, the murdered police officer, Jennifer Rogers, said that the defendant has not only taken Sean away from me, he's taken me away from me. She lashed out at the lawyers. There was a lot of anger at the lawyers simply for representing Tsarnaev. People resented the fact that they were talking to him or they might have smiled with him. Someone talked about them joking, and some of the people here made it clear they were disgusted by the behavior of the defense. And on it went. And, you know, we had, I mean, there were some notes, some moments of grace. Bill Richard, who's spoken before, the father, of course, of Martin Richard, the 8-year-old, he said to Zahar and to the court, he could have stopped his brother. He could have changed his mind. He chose to do nothing. He chose hate. He chose destruction. He chose death. We chose love. We chose kindness. We chose peace. This is our response to hate.
David Boyer, stand by a second, because I want to invite our listeners into this conversation. If you have questions or comments about today's proceeding, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I want to turn a moment to our analysts, to Don Stern and Nancy Gertner, just about this idea of victim impact statements. On a day when everything was, when there was no sort of suspense about what was going to happen today, I mean, I have this idea that everything that happens in a courtroom is defined and circumscribed by the law and for a purpose. So what's the purpose of an impact, of a victim impact statement on a day like today?
It's a, the statute was passed several years ago for the purpose of giving victims a role in the proceedings. The government, by rights, should be representing the victims, but what was discovered was that, in fact, the government was not keeping victims apprised of the proceedings, was not listening to their pain, was making decisions that were not necessarily consistent with what the victims wanted. Now, the victims' rights are the rights to participate, to be informed, to speak. They're not necessarily the right to determine the outcome. In other words, a victim can't say, I want him to get the death penalty, and therefore he gets death. And so that's why no victim, the victim's positions about the ultimate punishment, like the Richards position, would not have been known in any proceeding, because that is really not what their job is. Their job is to talk about their pain. The purpose of it is, one, to make sure that the system is responsive to the needs of victims, and in addition, for the victims, it's to make sure that they're heard. But, you know, when you step back from this, there have been three occasions of victim impact statements. The judge exercised his discretion to allow in considerable evidence about the victims in the trial. The judge allowed in considerable evidence about the victims in the sentencing, in the penalty phase, and the judge allowed in whatever the victims wanted to speak today in the sentencing phase itself. So they have been heard, and as David described, what you don't hear from are those who, for the most part, didn't want the death penalty, and those who would have accepted life without parole for this man. Let me just roll back a little bit, too. The proceeding today would have been the proceeding if Zahar Tsarnaev had pled guilty to life without parole. There could have been, not just today, there could have been a week-long, whatever the judge wanted, proceeding to deal with victim impacts, at the conclusion of which he would have gotten life without parole with no appeal. And I think it was significant that Judy Clark said that's what we offered all along, plus he would have cooperated with the government.
Donald Stern,
and they rejected that.
I mean, you were a former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts. Can I get your view from sort of your side of the desk, for lack of a better term, or bench, on victim impact statements and their import or their potential impact on any appeals process we might see going forward?
Well, to put into context, I mean, this is to some extent the end result, or the natural result, which I think is a good thing, of a victims' rights movement that really gathered steam in the 70s and 80s, because Judge Gertner is correct. I mean, for a long time, the criminal justice system ignored victims, not only ignored them, but treated them badly. They were part of the problem. So it was the defendant that had certain rights, the government had certain rights and obligations in terms of prosecuting, the victims were nowhere to be seen. And that's changed, actually changed first on the state system, not just in Massachusetts, which is one of the leaders, frankly, of victims' rights nationally, but changed around the country. The federal government, really Congress, recognized that pretty much in the 90s and put into federal law certain rights of the victims. So, which is a good thing in my view. It informs the process. It gives the victim some stake in the process. And by the way, the victims' rights is not just the opportunity to speak at sentencing, but to be notified of important proceedings, to be notified of plea hearings, to be notified of when the trial is, to be given, so in some cases, a separate place to congregate and to be without having to be with the defendant's family. It's to give some rights to the victims that they didn't have. So here's a little bit unusual, as David points out, because the statements really at the sentencing couldn't have had any effect because the jury has already spoken and it's required for the federal judge. But having said that, It's part of the process, and if, you know, victims had the opportunity, there was a self-selection process, but that's not a bad thing. You're not going to force a victim to come and give an impact statement. So the fact that it was self-selecting is kind of the nature of the beast. And
that's true.
If it made this horrible process a little bit easier for the victims, the opportunity to address him directly and an opportunity to speak, and for us to be talking about it, if that's the upshot of all that, I think that's a good thing.
It's interesting, though.
Can I add something?
Right in, David, please.
So Anthony, what's interesting that what Don's been talking about, there's been a further development on this. This was, and the Supreme Court upheld victim impact statements in the 1990s, and as Don talked about, the federal law that was passed. What the Supreme Court did not address in the 1990s when they upheld, in this case, Payne versus Tennessee, victim impact statements, they did not speak to whether or not victims could make recommendations as to what the sentence should be. And so all the courts, in the absence of a federal Supreme Court interpretation of that ruling, all the courts in the country have pretty much, except for Oklahoma, have prohibited victims from making statements about what the sentence should be. And I find it interesting, because the irony here was that some people would be able to make the statements and also say, we don't want the death penalty. But that obviously didn't happen.
David, stand by a second. We want to get a couple of callers into this conversation. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the news today. A federal judge has formally sentenced Jahar Tsarnaev to death. We also heard an apology from the convicted Boston Marathon bomber. Let's go to Larry, who's calling from Cambridge. Larry, you're on the air.
Yes. Well, I'm someone who have friends who lost legs and suffered mightily in the loss. And I've grieved for them since the very beginning. But I also knew the young Jahar, and I also knew two of the young men who were killed in Waltham.
Mm-hmm.
I knew police and fire people who were first responders. I'm calling because I'd never expected to hear that he would give a statement. As someone who had a lot of regard of a different person by the name of Jahar than the one who became the monster for this act, and who was traumatized and still am by everything that everyone has suffered, I just want to say a couple of things. The first is, I know that the pain is too deep for everyone in the city, and that the trauma that we've all continue. I think there's tons of post-traumatic stress everywhere, but it strikes me that he made a statement at all was something I didn't expect, and I don't know yet how to regard it. But I'll just say this, that I know many of his friends, his young friends. I know how they have suffered, as well as the people who lost limbs and who lost life. I don't know anyone who lost life, but I know people that lost limbs.
Sure.
I know what their lives have been ever since.
Larry, do you mind if I ask, you said you know Jahar. How do you know him?
I'll give myself away. I live near him. I taught at Ringe and Latin.
Hmm. Right, so you knew a very different...
I knew him for a long time.
Sure.
You know. And I knew something of the family. I was one of the first people to speak afterwards.
Larry, I'm curious what you made of the fact that throughout the trial there was he was so impassive. He expressed so little emotion.
Yeah. First of all, I suffered a lot because I said, you know, what a wonderful person he was, and I was speaking to somebody who completely was not was a monster. And a lot of people were very, very angry with me for what I said. And there are other people who said, well, at least you began to humanize him. And so I went through a whole lot of trauma because in my heart was the pain of everybody. I have close friends who lost legs, okay,
mm-hmm.
and have suffered since, mightily suffered and continue to suffer. And I have friends. So, the trial was actually a very, to tell you the truth, first of all, he was tried in a civilian court. Secondly, he was tried here. Thirdly, you know, he got some very good lawyers. Fourthly, you know, the death sentence, which I did not believe in. But through the trial, it was very grounding for me to hear the effect it had on people and hear the details of the crime and what it meant and how it happened, right? And it sort of brought me back to earth in a way, in a very troubling way. And then I felt like he shows no remorse, and I got angrier and angrier because his close friends, have suffered mightily ever since. I do not want to compare that to what the people who died and to their loved ones, and families that have suffered grievous wounds. I don't want to compare the two, right? But
the one thing that jarred,
friends, if you understand what I'm saying,
I do.
And they went from he didn't do it to. He did it.
Hey, Larry, you know? hang on here for just a second so we can get David Bowery back in the conversation. Hang on, Larry.
It's interesting. Larry maybe not remember this, and I just realized this is Larry. I met him the day after the bombings, actually, and he told me about Zahar. It was the day after the names came out. He told me about Zahar, told him, described him as a sweetheart of the kid and that somebody that couldn't possibly have done it. And that was representative of the shock of people when they heard that. But what Zahar Tzernayev did not do in court today was to give a reason for why he did what he did that might have made what he said more acceptable to many people in the courtroom. He apologized. He took ownership of it, apologized, said he prayed for them, asked for Allah's blessings, but didn't say what possessed him to do what he said he had done.
Well, and didn't say that he was sorry for having done it. He apologized and expressed regret for some of the harm, but I don't know how the families of the victims, what they're saying now to media and other people, but I hate to put myself.
I don't think they're at all. They are not at all moved.
The context is, I'm sorry for the harm, but let me give you some understanding of how that happened, and I'm sorry for having planted the bombs. He didn't say that.
Well, but I think you're parsing. What he's saying. I think you're needlessly parsing it. I'm not sure that any human being could have adequately shown remorse or adequately explained this act, and surely not a 19-year-old. So that it may well be that what he said was all that could possibly be said under the occasion, that all that he could have said under the occasion. I don't think that anything he said would have satisfied the people in that room.
It may not have satisfied. It may not have satisfied them. But you know, as you know far better than I, both of you, that the court, that anger and emotion have, you cannot pull them out of a courtroom or pretend they don't exist. They need to be managed, obviously, so people are not unduly prejudiced. But there was anger. There was anger and clear emotion there. And yes, they formed this opinion of him. They wanted more. Whether they would have been satisfied or not, I don't know. But he didn't. I did not hear him give reason to why he did what he did and to have renounced it. As one person in one of the more graceful of impact statements said, you know, you are now, and this is it's an interesting thing in trials like this, because there's an existential connection between him, the defendant, and those families, because he ultimately might someday, as it's happened before, try to actually meet with them face to face and try to answer their question. There is that possibility, but if someone said, you have the chance, you are in a position to actually have great influence, even though you've been convicted, you've been sentenced to death, because you can steer people the other way.
We've still got Larry on the line here, and I don't want to forget about him. Larry, I just have one last question for you. Now that we've reached this milestone, for lack of a better term, in this case, in this story, how are you? Are you able to move forward from this point?
It's going to take a long time. Let me just say that I'm a very strong believer and advocate of restorative justice, and this has been a real test for me as a believer in restorative justice, given the pain that I know on all sides. What was just spoken about, that someday, I guess I'm trying to have some hope that at some point before he's taken out, you know, that there is a restorative moment in which he acknowledges and explains. I mean, you know, he is only not, you know, he's a young man. And I do not want to defend what he did. It's lunacy what he did, okay? There's no question about that. And the thinking, you know, that I want to bring the pain that has been brought to all the people in the world, you know, by the United States action and so forth, this ideology, you know, I'm going to bring it home. I mean, it's the same thing that happened in Charleston. You know, you think I'm going to do this because I'm going to show everybody, and then you get the exact opposite reaction. But the point is, I think I'm hoping for some restorative justice at some point. The pain is too deep, right? The trauma for all of us is still lingering. But I am hopeful still, and that's why I don't agree with the death penalty, that at some point, you know, this is the first time I felt like, my God, he could say something. Mm-hmm. I didn't think he was going to say anything. But at least it opens a little tiny sliver of let us all begin to heal with some restorative justice. Not to defend what he did, if you understand what I'm saying. I'm just trying to...
Larry, you've expressed yourself really well. I'm really glad. We're all really glad you called in, and thank you. We're going to let you go and move on, but you put a lot on the table, and we're very grateful. Let's introduce the Reverend Liz Walker. She's a senior pastor at the Roxbury Presbyterian Church. And Reverend Walker, good to have you back.
Good to be here and listen to this conversation.
You've been listening, and we just heard. Let's just pick up on the point that Larry was talking about. This idea of restorative justice, is that sort of the next step here, or what are you thinking on this day?
Well, I'm thinking that perhaps, you know, this is a process. Perhaps there will be something more said or that would come from this young man. I don't think, I agree with the judge, and I don't think he's going to ever say something that's going to make any sense to people that he's hurt. I'm not sure that that's going to happen. But, you know, we just have to see. Perhaps he will stop the appellate process. Perhaps that would be more affirmation that there's sincerity behind what he's saying. Ultimately, this is between this young man and his God. This is between this young man and his heart, you know. So we can comment on it, and we can all decide what his meant was, what his motivation was. But ultimately, we don't know. You know, there's no way to really know. But I was very, I don't want to say touched, but I was surprised, like everyone else, because he had choices. He could have said many things or said nothing. So, you know, I think we'll have to wait and see.
Hmm. When you say you were surprised, though, surprised by...
By his statement.
I
expected him to say nothing, because
right.
You see, generally, you know, in the past, in these kind of circumstances, you see, you know, this kind of defiance that goes, you know, all the way down the road. So the choice of saying, I'm sorry, you know, I'm wondering, and again, I'm not trying in any way to lift this young man out of what he did, because what he did was reprehensible. But you might see this trying to get right, because, you know, apology has to be sincere. It has to include a statement of responsibility, and then there has to be some restitution. Well, as far as we're standing right now, he's going to give his life. So I don't know if that's restitution, but he's going to have a consequence. The sincerity, we don't know. But it's the idea that he took this position in the first place is amazing to me.
Reverend Walker, you know, we just talked yesterday about Charleston and the expressions of forgiveness that we saw at a bond hearing there. And you know, today we just heard Larry, who's one of the, you know, one of the many people who experienced what's happened in Boston over the past 2 years, saying that he still yearns for some sort of restoration, right? Some sort of restorative justice here. I mean, what do you think might be restorative to Boston?
You know, I pray that Larry, I pray that everyone can heal. And the Bible, the Quran, all of most of these kinds of doctrine or words, sacred words from different traditions, you know, speak to healing. So restorative justice, how it plays out, I don't know. How can you make up a life that's gone? But I think the idea of apology is the step in the right direction. Certainly the media is going to analyze this ad nauseum. We all are, right? But it is the step that you have to take. Apology and forgiveness work together, right? Repentance and then forgiveness. So I can only look at this and say this is between this young man and his God. Now, you can say it's between him and his lawyer and what they're trying to do, but ultimately, you know, he'll be judged for his whole life here. And restorative justice is when someone feels that remorse was sincere and it touched them. And I hope we can get to that, because that's maybe when healing can begin. And if that doesn't happen, I still hope healing can begin all the way around. And we have a lot of healing to do.
Reverend Liz Walker, she's the senior pastor at the Roxbury Presbyterian Church. Reverend Walker, thank you again for joining us. We're always very grateful to hear from you. Thank you very much. Nancy Gertner, I'd love to come to you with this sort of question of restorative justice. I mean, what does that mean to you?
It usually means an effort for the victims and the defendant to come face to face, so that the defendant can see the harm that he or she has done to the community, and deal with it and confront it in a way that the artificial setting of a court doesn't allow. Express remorse, the victims express forgiveness, and people can build from that. I hope that could happen here, but I doubt it. Mm-hmm. This is a crime of such enormity that, as I said, I'm not sure that anything he could have said would have counted as remorse for anyone in that room. And let me also say something as a judge. Defendants always expressed remorse, or most of the time, and these were canned. These were what they knew they had to say. So it's a moment that's fraught, which is how do you express remorse in a way that is in the heart, that really reflects who you are, and not just what you have to say for the moment. And since we weren't in court, we don't know whether that's what happened here. But restorative justice is a wonderful goal. It would be extremely difficult to imagine in a case of this enormity. One thing which could have, and again I'm speaking as a judge and a lawyer, which could have been helpful to the government, is the notion that he could have cooperated in some fashion with the government in exchange for a plea. And cooperation, which maybe could have helped us understand how someone like him, how this could happen. How he got access to the materials that he got access to.
Was there any indication from the government, though, that they would have been open to that?
Well, that was the point. That was part of the plea deal. That was offered by the defense was life imprisonment, plea, no appeals, and cooperation, and that was all rejected. Mm-hmm. And I think that people will be second-guessing that decision for years to come.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is special coverage of the sentencing hearing of Jahar Tsarnaev. We heard over the course of the day, a federal court heard many victim impact statements from victims and their family members of the Boston Marathon bombing. We also heard Jahar Tsarnaev speak and issue a form of an apology. He said to members of the court, "I am sorry for the lives I have taken and the suffering I cause, and the damage I've done, the irreparable damage." Judge O'Toole also spoke and said, "What will be remembered is you murdered and maimed innocent people, and you did it willfully and intentionally." We'd like to hear what you have to say, so give us a call with your thoughts on the day at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And David Boyer, do I hear you there?
No, I think that's Dawn Stern. Yeah, I'm dying to hear from.
I just want to make one more comment or observation about the statement. Judge Gertner made some reference to the fact that defendants will often express remorse, and so you know the judges get and prosecutors hear the same thing sometimes. You want to put it into context. I have trouble understanding his statements in the context of what we know to date. How that same person who says these words is the same person who sat through months of testimony, heart-wrenching testimony, with these same people, victims, family members of victims, photographs, tears, and all of that, and show absolutely no emotion whatsoever. And remember, even at the penalty phase, one of the defense witnesses was a nun who had visited him in prison, and her testimony was the effect, "I thought he was sorry because I could see it in his eyes." We didn't hear any of these words, even after several visits, and I can't remember how many visits and how many hours she sat with him. So are we to believe that there is this transformation which took place today or between the sentence, the penalty phase, and now? And that's why I come back to it. I don't mean to be overly cynical, and Judge Gertner said maybe I'm parsing words. I don't know that this was a full-throated apology as much as...
I can't
as,
see how you can call it that.
Yeah. And so, you know, call me a cynic, but if I were... it is what it is, and maybe people will all be parsing these words. I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I'm not sure it really is what... maybe some people think it is, which is he's apologizing for the harm. Yeah, he's sorry some people lost legs, and he's sorry some people got killed, but I didn't hear him say, I'm sorry I planted the bomb.
Mm-hmm. The lack of remorse, Don, keeps on coming back in the statements of the victims in this case. It keeps on coming back in the testimony in that second phase of the trial when they were dealing with the penalty. Lack of remorse, implacable demeanor. There's that. And it's clear to me that this jury, and I saw it, I think, in the verdicts themselves, that this jury operated out of emotion and anger in that toward the defendant, both in regards to that lack, that impassivity, but also, of course, to the testimony of what had happened, you know, with all the victims testifying about what had happened to them. And the idea that here's somebody who stood for 4 minutes when there was a bomb that was about to go off, and he saw where it was, and he saw who was around there, and he did nothing. You know, this was... And then, of course, you have what was on the inside of the boat that does, certainly doesn't make anything. And that's the
his
the,
writing the on the inside of the boat
statement. Right. That's the most fulsome statement we've had from him about what he did.
And David, for the benefit of our listeners, remind us what was on the inside of that boat.
Muslims were at war with the United States.
Right.
That the United States was killing innocent people, and he was at war, and he felt at war. O'Toole, quoting from both Verdi and Shakespeare today, said to Jannar, he said that Johar Zanayev, excuse me, somebody that believes in the deliberate killing and maiming of innocents is somebody that believes in a cruel God. And a cruel God cannot be the God of Islam. Hmm.
You're quoting Judge George O'Toole there. Stand by, David. I just want to reset this conversation for our listeners in case they're just joining us. We're talking about Johar Tsarnaev today. He actually apologized in federal court shortly after that. A federal judge formally sentenced him to death. We're taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255. With us is David Boeri, senior reporter for WBUR, Donald Stern, former U.S. attorney, and Nancy Gertner, former U.S. judge. So let's take a couple of calls because we've got a bunch of them backed up here. Maddie is calling from Jamaica Plain. Maddie, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I, as a young person, I'm sort of trying to imagine what this whole experience, you know, must be like for somebody who was only 19 years old at the time that this happened, you know, for Tsarnaev. And I feel that I personally want to, you know, be careful that we walk the line between trying to, you know, interpret his words and actions and speculating about, you know, an internal experience instead of feelings that we really can't know. And I just feel that if his apology is sincere and if truly he's, you know, come to understand sort of the magnitude, the enormity of what he's done and the impact it's had, how surreal an experience for a young person it must be to, you know, go through this trial and be sentenced to death. And so because of that, I sort of think, you know, I could sort of understand why maybe, you know, his expression, he was sort of expressionless throughout the trial. And, you know, maybe it was surreal for him. We don't know. But I'm sort of wanting to question the idea that, you know, he didn't show enough remorse, because I'm not really sure what folks think that should look like. You know, should he have been crying hysterically throughout the trial? Should he have thrown himself on the ground? I mean, you know, I'm not trying to say or to belittle, you know, the feelings of folks that, you know, he wasn't connecting with what was happening, but I think we can't really speculate how he was feeling based on, you know, the few pictures and stuff that we have from him inside the courtroom.
Maddie, thank you so much for your call. Donald Stern, do you have an answer to that? What would enough remorse look like? Is there an answer?
A spark of humanity. I'm not sure there's any recipe. I think, you know, Maddie makes a point. I don't know that it's a canned response. But even 19-year-olds are capable of showing some emotion and humanity. And
let's recall, he did show emotion during the case when his aunt testified.
Exactly.
That moved him to tears.
So he's capable of tears. He's capable of showing emotion. He didn't seem to be capable of showing emotion when the victims were testifying or others were testifying about tending to the first responders, for example, testified as to the horror they saw when they showed up at the scene.
Judges who have presided over death penalty cases have said that it's not at all unusual for the defendant to be completely impassive during the trial, in part because they know if there's a meaningful contest about guilt or innocence, because they fear that if they show anything, they will tilt the proceedings in some way, and they're literally holding themselves in. And it's not unusual for them to have a show of emotion then at sentencing when there's actually a one-to-one confrontation with the victims in the case. Now, whether this qualifies as that show of emotion, I don't know. We weren't there. David at one point described that he had to compose himself in the midst of this proceeding. We don't know. But
He did stop.
But so that general,
Nancy, in fairness, that general pattern,
other judges have, you know, the difference between holding yourself in during the course of the trial and then falling apart at sentencing in some fashion, that is something that other judges have seen. But, you know, in addition, the enormity of what he is facing, I'm not sure that you need a psychiatrist in this chair and not a former judge, but whether or not the defense mechanisms in order to hold you together are so powerful that even if your lawyer said, as I don't doubt that they said, Jokhar, so show some emotion, break down, it's fine, that he couldn't have done it. I have no doubt that, you know, that that's a likely scenario any lawyer would have done that, but that he feared if he let go, then the entire...
Yeah, and
you
I still keep
make it through.
And I keep coming back to the same question that's already been posed by a couple of you, and that is, what on earth could he have? Even if he had done that, would it have been enough?
Right.
Would it have sent the message to, I don't know, to us, to the folks in the courtroom, to the victims' families, that, oh, there's something sincere going on there?
Actually, Anthony, just outside the courtroom now, we have one of the victims speaking, so let's listen.
Can't be with us today, and they'd be here to speak for themselves if they could. I just wanted to vent a little bit about the first time we heard his voice today. Nobody really realized that we didn't know what he sounded like after 2 years. And after we heard it, we wish we hadn't, because the things he had to say were sort of shocking. He talked at first about Allah and this being the month of forgiveness, implying that we should all forgive him. And the last thing we wanted to hear was about Allah and why he did this in the first place and changed all our lives forever. And then he went on to Oscar-type speech, thanking the judge and thanking the jury and thanking his legal team and those who couldn't be here and his family for testifying and making, and I quote, making my life easy for the past 2 years. Well, our lives have been anything but easy. And our lives will never be the same again. I live a block from the finish line, and my neighborhood has changed forever. He threw in an apology to the survivors that seemed insincere and just thrown in because he was supposed to, and then ended again with Allah talking about leniency, implying that we should now be lenient to him because Allah says so. And I just was unaware that he would get up and just say whatever he wanted, and that's the law. And I regret having ever wanted to hear him speak, because what he said showed no remorse, no regret, and no empathy for what he's done to our lives.
Can you spell
your name real quick? Lynn Julian.
We're listening to Lynn Julian. This is courtesy of Newland Cable News. She's a Boston Marathon survivor speaking right now outside of the Moakley Federal Courthouse in South Boston.
Brain injury, permanent hearing loss in both ears, and a back injury, and the worst of all is post-traumatic stress, because... of all is post-traumatic stress. Because...
Do you think she should get the death penalty or life?
I don't think that either of those things are going to change anything for any of us. It's never going to bring back our old lives. I lived in perhaps a false bubble of security that I would go to all the Boston events just like so many people and never feel unsafe, never worry. And now we feel like we're the police. We are the judge and jury of everyone around us, grading their safety level and how much threat they might cause us at any given time, just riding the T. And I'm never going to look at Boston or the world the same again. And none of us are, because they took so much more than innocent people's lives. They took our sense of security. They took our sense of safety. We can never leave our homes again and just take a walk without wondering and judging everybody else that walks by us.
Why do you think he spoke? Why do you think he spoke today?
So, I would like to speak. My name is Scott Weisberg. I'm one of the survivors as well, and I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. I am a family physician, and I specifically came up today to tell my story. I, as a family physician, have hidden and invisible injuries, which most of the media are not aware of. Those injuries, for me, are bilateral hearing loss, for which I wear hearing aids. I've been wearing them since August of 2013. I also have a mild traumatic brain injury. In addition, have PTSD as well. And part of today for me was to explain what it's been like to live with, for the last 2 years, these injuries. To all of you, I look completely normal. But inside, I have significant injuries that I've been living with and going through. And as a physician, and having to go through the struggles of getting diagnosed and having to convince medical professionals what it's like to have injuries and to seek the proper care, part of my treatment has been to make the public aware and also to be an advocate for other survivors. So one of my goals and missions ever since this, since I've been diagnosed, which took me 16 months to get my diagnosis, is to be an advocate for other survivors and for other future events where if somebody has a hearing loss or a brain injury, where do they go? How do they get care? Where do you, so that they can be treated effectively right from the beginning? And that is one of my main purposes for being here today in this courtroom and coming from Alabama.
What did you think of Mr. Sarnaev's speech?
So I was surprised that he spoke. I think most of the survivors were that he spoke today. He said that he was remorseful. I find that hard to believe since I've come to a lot of the trial and never really saw that at all from him. It really does not change anything for me because what he took from me, I'm never going to be able to regain, nor what he took from my family. Nor from any of us as well. I think he spoke because people were sort of expecting that from him. Since everybody during the trial was commenting on him not making any comments and his lack of remorse and no facial expression. So this was that one last moment for him to kind of just put things aside.
Do you think it was sincere?
I don't think it was genuine, but that he will say otherwise. And that's not going to change my impression of him or what he did to us. Basically, as was said by, you know, people this morning, is what this tragedy has done is it has made us stronger as a survivor community, and more importantly, it has made us more resilient, and we are still alive. There's four people that aren't, but the rest of us are, and we as a community are going to be stronger, and we're going to continue to heal through this. And the main thing for me and speaking was that we will not be forgotten.
You talked in the court about how your life has been completely ruined in a split
second, the after effect of that is completely destroyed your life as you knew it. What did it mean to you to be able to stand up in court and say that, and at least, if he wasn't looking at you, he at least heard you? What did that mean to you?
To me, being able to finally express what I've been holding in for 2 years was very powerful. It gave me the opportunity to let not only the media, the defense, the judge, even the jurors, have an opportunity to hear from a survivor that basically has these hidden and invisible injuries, that when you see me on the street, I look completely normal. You know, if I pull out of my hearing aids, then you'll see that I wear hearing aids. You know, the brain injury, you can't see. It's not something that's visible. The PTSD, you're not going to see that. So for me, it was the idea of actually being able to physically express all those feelings that I've been dealing with for 2 years and verbally being able to express it to the public.
So that was Scott Weisberg. He's a family physician from Birmingham, Alabama, one of the survivors. He ran the marathon, crossed the finish line seconds before the bombs went off. If you're just joining us, we are talking about Jahar Tsarnaev. He was formally sentenced to death today in federal court. He also expressed an apology of sorts. We're getting a lot of reaction from some of the survivors about that. With us in the studio is Donald Stern, former U.S. attorney, and former federal judge Nancy Gertner, who we have to bid goodbye to. Nancy, thank you for your help
today.
You're
very welcome.
As always,
thanks
and good
a lot.
Luck to you. And let me introduce David Hoos. He's a Northampton defense attorney. He's helped us in the past analyze this long and difficult case. And David Hoos, good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Can you give us your reaction? Were you surprised that Jahar Tsarnaev chose to make a statement?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised because, as everyone has already said, the outcome was clear. I'm sure it's something that was discussed with his defense team, and I don't want to suggest by anything that I say that I would second guess anything that the defense team decided to do. Although even in that, I'm making an assumption. I mean, you know, we all as defense lawyers, we have to live with our client, and he may or may not have followed their advice. They may have suggested that he not speak. He may have insisted on speaking. I think that what strikes me about the conversation that I've been listening to for the last half hour or so is how it's based on this, what I think is a real fallacy, and that is that we can discern by looking at someone or listening to their words whether or not they actually feel remorse or not. So many people have said he sat there stoically throughout the trial. He didn't show any emotion. And we want to assume that from that, he wasn't feeling any remorse. I don't know that that's necessarily true. And I agree with the words of Judge Gertner that I don't think there was anything that this kid could have said that was going to make anyone feel better, make the judge do anything different. So from that perspective, I suppose there was little point in him saying anything.
But do you think would it have made a difference if we had heard from him or if the survivors had heard from him earlier in the process?
Well, you know, I don't know that that is a really, really very realistic to expect. I mean, you have to start with the understanding that this guy got himself to a mental and emotional state where he could do all of the horrible things that he did, stand there and wait for 4 minutes while a bomb was going to go off, knowing the devastation that it was going to wreak. You don't the next day say, gee, I really feel bad about that, and begin to say anything that sounds real in terms of remorse. I think that remorse is a process. And maybe the point of him speaking today was to sort of lay a foundation for that. This man, as has been emphasized throughout this trial by the defense, is a very, very young man. And he may be really just now coming to grips with what he has done. And the remorse, whatever little bit of remorse he feels now, may be something that he is able to expand upon and articulate more fully.
Well, David, if I may ask you, I mean, this is a question we asked of Judge Gertner and Donald Stern a little while ago, but from your perspective as a defense attorney, you know, Judge Gertner said that Tsarnaev's defense team didn't feel like they could start this process earlier by putting him on the stand during the trial or the penalty phase of the trial because they risked cross-examination. I mean, as a defense attorney, can you just tell us exactly, you know, what would the risk have been since they had opened their case by saying he did it?
Well, you know, I think that to expect a young man of 19 years in the most high-profile case in probably in the country in the last 10 years or so to get on the witness stand and subject himself to cross-examination and sell himself as being truly remorseful for the acts that he committed is really, it would be a lot to ask for a sophisticated, articulate speaker, which I'm sure that Mr. Tsarnaev is not. So that is why I think defense lawyers, in a nutshell, are reluctant to put their clients on the stand.
David, I'm sorry to interrupt here for just a second, but there is a bombing survivor, Henry Beauregard, who's speaking at the courtroom in front of the courthouse just now, and he's telling the media, we're going to go to him, that he actually forgives Tsarnaev. So let's hear more of what he has to say.
I made the mistake of looking over at him while I was giving my statement, and he was looking right at me, which was a little disconcerting, and I had to resort to reading directly off of my little script that I had in front of me after that. I wasn't expecting that, being that he hasn't had any real reaction in court other than the one with his aunt.
So you made eye contact?
Yes.
What did that feel like?
You know, he's a human being. I don't know to what extent my forgiveness extends, but what I do know is that I believe in second chances. And I, when I made eye contact with him, it wasn't like looking in the face of a criminal. It was like looking in the face of a boy, because I'm going to be 24 in a couple days. Happy birthday. And he's younger than me, and that's been something that's really been a hang-up for me to reconcile the fact that I was at the second explosion, to reconcile the fact that the man, the boy who planted that bomb that blew up in front of me is younger than I am. So that's something that's been very difficult to process.
Hey, guys, last question. Is there anything where your victim impact statements that Lynn or you Scott could say basically?
I just feel like the bubble is burst. Perhaps we didn't know we lived in a bubble before. Perhaps we took our security and our sense of safety for granted every time we went out to Fenway Park or TD Garden or just to Boston Common, and now we take nothing for granted.
This is Boston Marathon bombing survivor Lynn Julian.
Fight or flight. We are hyper aware of everything going on around us, and it's both embarrassing and exhausting.
Agreed.
And so basically in my my speech, basically as a family physician, which is what I am as a marathon runner that day, I emphasize the idea that my injuries that I suffered and continue to are invisible and hidden, what it's like to live with those, and the challenges of basically presenting myself as like one of you, and what's really going on the inside on a day-to-day basis, and how this is going to be a lifelong process of relearning and reinventing myself and refiguring out my new identity, and not only mine, but as a survivor community. And that's my main mission, is so that we're not forgotten, because you can't see those injuries, and that we need resources, that we're going to need to continue to seek medical care, professional opinions. And if the one good can come out of this from this event is that there's more public recognition for how to diagnose sudden hearing loss, tinnitus, mild traumatic brain injury, PTSD, and how to get that care right away so that people don't have to search and struggle to where to turn to get that medical care and expertise.
We hope our work
with the that was Dr. Scott Weisberg from Alabama, who ran the marathon back in 2013. And a little earlier, you heard in that live press conference from Boston Marathon bombing survivors Lynn Julian and Henry Borgard, who actually said he forgives Tsarnaev, that he still has faith in humanity, including in Tsarnaev, and that he was rather disturbed at looking that when he looked at Tsarnaev, what he saw was the face of a boy. That from bombing survivor
Henry
Borgard.
Which he identified with personally, being only 23 years old. Yeah. Interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's take a call here. Joe is calling from Melbourne, Florida. You're on the air, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What a range of emotions. First, I'm not against the death penalty under any circumstances, but the age and influence of Tsarnaev's brother and him being 19 does touch me somewhat. I remember Malvo, Lee Boyd Malvo, the Beltway sniper shootings and the influence John Muhammad had over him. I remember Patty Hearst. I'm old enough to remember what Patty Hearst, her kidnapping. And I just at 19, I think the influence of people that we wrap our lives around has a great bearing. And I do think, I know if I were the father of any victim, the idea that I might pass while the person who took my loved one's life, I might pass before him would slay me on one hand. But on the other, I think that at the age of 19, there was great influence. And I do think that life without parole would have been my preference. I thank you for the time.
All right, Joe, we really appreciate you putting that thought on the table. David Hoos, defense attorney, joining us from Northampton. Love you to respond to what Joe was talking about there, talking about the mitigating factor that might have spared Jahar Tsarnaev the death penalty. Of course, it didn't, but why didn't it?
Well, that's a good question because I thought the defense team did a great job in developing that combination of youth and the strife that was going on in the family, which led to really a sort of an abdication by the parents and leaving him in control of or under the supervision of an older brother who was clearly radicalized, if not mentally ill and violent. I was somewhat surprised when the verdict came in that more of the jurors were not affected by that, which of course, leads to the whole issue that is really at the cornerstone of the future in terms of appeals, which is, the venue and having the trial, jury selection and having the trial in Boston to start with.
I want to actually talk a little bit about the future of this legal process and the appeals process. But Donald Stern, I'd love to get your reaction to Joe's phone call about the power or, how a young person, 19, can be so affected by the elders around him.
Well, the defense team has to sort of play the cards that they've been dealt. And I thought they did that effectively in the sense that, the strongest suit they had was really he's young, he's under the influence of the older brother, and I thought they played that out probably as well as they could have. I think the missing piece to that again was the affect, if you will, for the defendant. I don't blame the lawyers for that. I think that's who the defendant is. People have asked me, were you surprised with the outcome of the jury? I was prepared to not be surprised either way. I mean, I thought. There probably is a good likelihood that there'd be a few members of the jury that would agree with your last caller, that they would take into account his youth and the testimony from some of his former teachers and others that somehow this was not who he really was. And so I was a little bit surprised, actually, with how quickly the jury came back. I mean, I wasn't surprised necessarily with the outcome. I don't know what that means. I'm not being critical of the jury because I have to say, You know, and David knows this. You know, if you're not there every day, if you're not hearing every scrap of testimony, if you're not in the courtroom, you really don't know all the facts. And so the rest of us are relying really upon media accounts. That's probably an argument for having TVs in the courtroom so that we can have access to that information. So the jury heard something and heard it very powerfully and permitted them
Don,
to
sir,
come back
we're
going
to cut you off here because it looks like U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz is just about to step up to the microphone outside the Merkley Federal Courthouse.
Good afternoon, everyone. I just want to say today that we are all feeling very gratified that we're at this stage of the proceedings where the judge has imposed a sentence in this case. And so we've arrived at the end of another chapter in this long process and in these criminal proceedings. Many of you who listened to what was happening in the courtroom today really was a day not just for the conclusion of this piece of it, but really for the victims to have a voice. And many of them had submitted victim impact statements, but they also had made oral statements today. And so I just want to say that today was an incredibly powerful day. The judge formally imposed his sentence of the death penalty for certain counts, as well as then consecutive life sentences on other counts. But critically important was the voices that we heard from the victims who talked about the impact of the crime and what they have been through and what this has meant to them. And from the very beginning, and I just recently came from, we had a meeting with many of the victims, I noted and I said from the very beginning, I have been so touched and so moved and inspired by their strength, their courage, and their resiliency. And also voices of hope. In that courtroom today, I felt proud that not just to be a Bostonian, but also to be an American, because you heard a number of victims say, not only are we Boston strong, but we are America strong. I hope that the presentation of this case, in terms of viewing all of the evidence, has really exhibited again what a fair and impartial jury system we have in this country. And we believe that at the end of the day, the punishment that was rendered by the jury appropriately fitted the crime, a crime of terrorism, a crime that was not religiously motivated, and a crime that was intended to coerce and intimidate our country. But the response has been otherwise. And finally, I just want to conclude by thanking the FBI, my colleague here, Special Agent in Charge, Vince Lissy, as well as the ATF, State Police, Boston PD, all the other law enforcement agencies that we have worked with from the very beginning. They have worked tirelessly, along with my prosecution team, the assistant U.S. attorneys who presented the case in court, and have done tremendous work. And we hope that that was really on display for all to see, our system of justice. Thank you, Vince.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. You know, from the moment those bombs detonated on Boylston Street, the victims, survivors, and their families have had to deal with unthinkable pain and overcome countless obstacles. And while there's no one-size-fits-all healing process, I do think that there are certain events.
This is Vince Lisi, Special Agent in Charge, FBI.
A horrific day. We all know that there's nothing in the world, nothing at all, that can take away their pain or return things to the way they are or the way they were, including today's sentence. But I hope that today's proceedings can serve as a milestone as they continue in their healing process. And I just want to let everybody know who was impacted by that savage attack that, you know, the FBI family will keep them in our thoughts and prayers. Thank you.
Yes. Well, I don't want to venture a personal opinion on this, but in general, what I was struck more was by what he didn't say. He didn't renounce terrorism. He didn't renounce violent extremism. And he couched his comments in line with Allah and Allah's views, which give it a religious tone. And there was nothing, as you heard Judge O'Toole say in the courtroom, there was nothing about this crime that was Islam associated. And so that's what I was struck by more.
How can you say it?
That is a skewed view of the religion of Islam. That is not what Islam is all about. And so when individuals utilize that, it is a radicalized view of that ideology. It's a radical ideology which really isn't at the heart of what is truly a peaceful and loving religion. She mentioned that in court, and I don't want to get into discussions that attorneys have behind the scenes, not only in this, but in many criminal cases. What I will say is that that statement, as it was made in court, was not completely accurate, and it was incomplete.
Was the part about the apology inaccurate?
I really don't want to specify what that comment referred to, really. It wasn't an apology.
Is this case made the case for cameras in federal courtrooms?
In terms of, would it be more appropriate? You know, I wouldn't want to voice my own personal opinions on cameras in the courtroom. I will say that because of our limitations that we don't have cameras in the courtroom, you all do an amazing job of tweeting the process so that someone outside the courtroom feels as if they're inside the courtroom reading, you know, your messaging in terms of the testimony, the evidence that's being presented. Yeah, it would be best to have a public display, but I'm not speaking for the department right now.
U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz speaking outside of the Moakley Courthouse in South Boston. She called this a powerful day. It was a day when a judge sentenced Jahar Tsarnaev to death for his role in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. She said, "We've arrived at the end of another long chapter in this case." And with us right now in the studio is Donald Stern. He's a former U.S. attorney. Also joining us from Northampton, defense attorney David Hoos. So, Donald Stern, I'd love to come to you. I mean, there's Carmen Ortiz talking about we're at the end of another long chapter in this case, and there are more chapters to come. What happens next with this appeals process? I mean, for instance, do we know, does Jahar Tsarnaev keep the same legal team?
Right.
I think he'll probably keep some of the same legal team, and sometimes there'll be others added to it who have a particular specialty when it comes to appellate matters. David probably knows this better. I'm not sure. I think probably that maybe a few of the defense team will fall off and maybe others will be added.
Yeah. I'm not sure if David Boeri is still with us. But David Hoos says, David, let me ask you the same question.
Yeah, he's going to get a new defense team, and that's not unusual in a death penalty case or, frankly, in any serious criminal case. I mean, it's sort of presumed, at least from the defense perspective, that you shouldn't be doing your own appeals. And part of the reason for that is because no matter how good you are, and I think everyone agrees that Mr. Tsarnaev had the best team that I can imagine, no matter who they are, no matter how good they are, people can make mistakes. And it's always better and more appropriate for a second fresh set of eyes to take over the appellate process. I'm sure it'll be a seamless handoff. I'm sure that Judy and David and Miriam and the rest of the defense team will continue to be cooperative with the team that comes on continue to work with Mr. Tsarnaev as he has handed off to the appellate team.
And David, do the proceedings stay in Boston or do they move elsewhere?
Well, the initial proceeding will be what we refer to as the direct appeal. The direct appeal will be to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. And as we all know, that's in exactly the same courthouse as where the trial was. Mm-hmm. So for the short term, everything is going to be right there in Boston.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is special coverage of the formal sentencing of Jahar Tsarnaev. Federal Judge George O'Toole has officially sentenced Tsarnaev to death. We heard many victim impact statements today, everything from survivor Jean Marie Parker, who said, "My only hope is that you own this grief for the rest of your natural life." And marathon runner Megan Zippin also said, In court, I'm the one who is alive. The defendant is already dead. Bill Richard, of course, father of 8-year-old victim Martin Richard, says this is all on him. He chose destruction. He chose to do nothing to prevent all this from happening. We chose kindness and we chose peace. Jahar Tsarnaev, of course, himself issued a statement apologizing in a manner of speaking for the suffering and the death caused by the bombings. We're joined by David Hoos. He's a Northampton defense attorney. He's joining us from New England Public Radio in Springfield, and also by Donald Stern, former U.S. Attorney. And we'll take your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Don Stern, from your you know, perspective as a former U.S. attorney, you know, what does Carmen Ortiz and her team, what are they thinking about now as the appeals process, you know, basically starts today? What are their primary concerns?
You know, their primary concerns is protecting the outcome. That's clearly what they want to happen. My prediction is the appellate team on the government side will be some combination. It'll probably be led by an appellate lawyer out of the Department of Justice who specializes, and I don't know who it's going to be, but who specializes in death penalty cases, coupled with probably one or more members of the trial team. Because, you know, David Hoos makes a point that sometimes a fresh set of eyes, particularly from the defense side, is helpful. On the other hand, you want somebody who knows the record quite well and somebody who's familiar with the case and maybe has some understanding as to why certain decisions were made. The appeal will probably be led by somebody out of the Department of Justice. And it's a lengthy process. I mean, just when you think about just preparing the transcript, just preparing the record in a case like this is going to take some time. So this is going to play out over years, not months. And the appeal ultimately will be heard, as David says, in that same courtroom, in same courthouse, rather.
We've got WBUR senior reporter David Boeri back. He's been at the Moakley courthouse all day today, and actually for a good portion of his life in recent times. David Boeri, what's going on there? What are you observing? What are you thinking about at this point in the afternoon?
So I go back to that courtroom and today, and I'm telling you, Anthony, there was death that was draped from each corner of it. The ceiling was low. The air was hard to breathe. You heard what we've heard throughout this trial, this time in the form of victim impact statements. The people that were delivering them weren't on cross-examination. They were doing what's called allocution. They were speaking from their hearts. They were making small speeches. But we heard that continued pain, the anger at what had happened. It struck me, again, that this was it certainly wasn't for the purpose of setting or determining the sentence for Tsarnaev, which had been set in the middle of last month. It was more along those lines they talk about what victim.
Looks like we lost David there. David, can you hear us? Nope, looks like we lost David Boeri. Well, let's take a call here. Let's go to Waltham, where Charlene's calling. You're on the air, Charlene.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I think it was very well spoken by Agent Lisi and USAG Ortiz. I grew up Muslim, and nowhere in my upbringing was I taught to hurt people. So I don't know how he could correlate his evil actions to Islam. And now as a mother and a Christian, every time I hear his name, my heart breaks for little Martin. I don't know if you remember the little picture of him holding up a sign saying, no more hurting people.
Of course, yeah.
And that message can only be realized, and we can only honor his memory if us as parents teach our children to love everyone. Because if a child is taught to fear God and to love and respect people, they can't grow up to be a Tsarnaev. So I have to echo Reverend Walter's statement that says at the end of the day, he has to answer to God. And my Bible says that whatever a man sows, he'll reap. So he came to Boston, he sowed death, and today he reaps a death sentence.
Well, let's go to Charlene. Thank you for that. We appreciate the call. We appreciate the sentiment that you expressed about this. If you want to join the conversation, we're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the formal sentencing of Jahar Tsarnaev today by a federal judge to the death sentence for his role in the Boston Marathon bombing. Let's go to Nancy, who's calling from Framingham. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, Yes, good afternoon. I'm also a supporter and sustainer of the station. I just want to say, and this has been my own opinion all along, before the conviction, before the actual conviction of the crime and before the sentencing, my opinion is if somebody wants to get rid of Joker, as I call him, not Joker, but Joker, just put him on a, just abandon him on a deserted island and let him suffer and let the birds peck at him for eternity.
All right, Nancy, we've got it. And let's move on to Mark, who's calling from Carlisle. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, fine, thanks. I reminiscent of that last call, sort of, that, you know, we're such a romantic society that we're spending tens of millions on this gentleman, and we'll continue with the appeal and so on. And one person is, you know, costing that much. I mean, if you had 100 or 1,000 of these people, they could actually bankrupt this country because... of, you know, our legal system, of which we're so proud. You know, if an Islamic country would have, you know, blinded and cut off his hands and cut off his head within 30 days.
Well, which system do you prefer, Mark? Would you prefer the system that cuts off his hands and blinds him or gives him a fair trial?
No, well, I prefer that we act with expediency and not draw out in a romantic way this thing, okay? In the Second World War, to end that war, we bombed Dresden and killed 135,000 civilians, period. And the Japanese, 71,000. In 1 minute with the atomic bomb. And yet we're spending $10 million on this one man.
Okay, Mark, we got it. I want to give a couple of legal experts in our studio a chance to respond to you. David Hoos, I mean, respond to Mark's idea that this money is money not well spent on a criminal justice system and the deliverance of justice when it comes to Jahar Tsarnaev's case.
Well, you know, I think Mark has a pretty extreme view, and I think that even most supporters of the death penalty in this country want it to be administered in a fair and impartial way. And what we see over and over again is that we have great difficulty in doing that. You know, I think your response to Mark was right on the money. I can remember Henry Schwarzschild years ago saying that he had no doubt that you could devise a death penalty system that would, in fact, deter crime. And the example he gave is, you know, you could put somebody out on the turnpike and everybody who's going 66 miles an hour, you pull them out of the car and execute them and speeding would cease to exist. But he said, I don't think I want to live in that kind of country. And I don't either, and I don't think Mark would either.
We still have Mark there? Because I'm curious. Is Mark, are you still with us? Would you like to live in that kind of country?
Well, how about the British system, which quite recently, upon the conviction of a death penalty case, someone will be executed, hung, within a relatively short period of time. You know, we go to such extremes to show how fair we are. And, of course, we pay lawyers. Wouldn't 1,000 people like this begin to bankrupt the country?
I still don't understand. Mark, I mean, I just guess I don't understand exactly what you're saying, that do you not want a system of jurisprudence in the United States where everybody gets a fair trial, some of whom come out the other end as being found innocent?
No. In this case, we know the person was not innocent, okay? So it's not a matter of innocence. It's a matter of going to extremes to show how good we are. Did you think that the rest of the population accused of murder gets this $10 million dream lawyer group?
All right, Mark, thank you for your perspective. Thanks so much for calling. Let's take another call. It's Mike from Jamaica Plain. You're on the air, Mike.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, what's your thought?
Okay. So I think my question is a simple one. I'm really just curious what the legal process is at this point. In other words, are those legal experts who are trying to bring this case, are they trying to break down the case that currently just went through? Are they looking for holes? Are they looking for lack of impartiality from jurors? I mean, what exactly is their approach going to be?
Mike, thanks so much for your call. David Hoos, I guess that's a good question for you. What could possible grounds for appeal be?
Well, you know, when I think about it, I think about really three issues, all of which are sort of related. And the first one is the one that everybody is aware of, which is the venue issue, whether the case should have been tried in Boston to begin with. And, of course, we know that at least one member of the First Circuit, Justice Torea, has expressed in no uncertain terms that he could not see how this case could be tried in Boston. And to echo his words, which he somewhat famously said in his opinion, we're all victims here. How can we possibly try this case fairly? Related ground of appeal, and of course we know very little about this because so much of this was under seal and in a courtroom without access by the meaningful access by the media, was the selection of the jurors. We don't know who was qualified, who was disqualified, on exactly what grounds, and that is always fertile ground for appeal. It's not unusual to see in an appellate brief words to the effect of, well, the court erred when it permitted juror number 497 to sit because of his responses regarding the death penalty. And the last thing, which is something we've talked about a lot today, which is victim impact testimony. Victim impact testimony is totally fine and appropriate for a day like today. But when it's held in the penalty phase of trial, where there has already been so much victim impact testimony in the guilt innocence phase of the trial, one has to wonder whether or not we created an environment where the jury was making its decision based on passion and emotion. All of us lawyers and judges, I wish Judge Gertner were here because she could probably quote you some of the instructions. But the jury is always told that your decisions shouldn't be made on the basis of passion or emotion. It's hard to imagine that passion and emotion didn't rule the day in this case.
Hmm. And you say that, David, who specifically because of the victim impact statements on this particular day?
No, not on this particular day. Those that were made at the penalty phase of the trial.
I see.
Maybe I can explain that a little bit. In other words, by the nature of the offense, the jury was in the guilt phase going to hear an awful lot about the horrible things that had happened to people. In the penalty phase of the trial, as Judge Gertner talked about earlier, David Boeri as well, in Payne versus Tennessee back in 1990, the Supreme Court reversed a decision that it had made in the 80s, saying we are going to permit victim impact testimony, but it is going to be very circumscribed and limited. We will allow the jury to hear a brief snapshot of the life that was extinguished. We will not allow the victims to express an opinion on what the proper sentence should be, and so on and so forth. And the question that always gets raised on appeals is, did we go beyond a brief snapshot? Did we allow so much victim impact testimony to come in that it effectively overwhelmed the ability of the jurors to make a verdict to reach a verdict that was free of passion and emotion?
Got it. What do you think, Donald Stern? Did the pendulum swing too much in favor of
It's certainly going to be an issue on appeal. You'd have to, you know, scour the trial transcript in a close way, which none of us have in front of us, to see whether that was permitted. I think the judge, I would think, you know, knowing Judge O'Toole, that he would be careful to protect the record. But that's going to be one of the issues, whether he you know, the needle went too far. I just want to go back to one of the earlier calls and make one observation. You know, I think it was Mark, and I certainly prefer our present system where we afford all due rights and all constitutional rights to defendants, particularly in capital cases. But at the very end, he made a point which is worth mentioning, which is the team that was assembled here and the resources that are assembled here are not the resources that are given in every capital case around America. Mm. And that is one of the problems, one of the serious problems with the death penalty, is as good as this lawyer team was and as careful as the judge was and as many rights were afforded this defendant, that's not necessarily the case around the country, and there is a grave disparity between the full panoply of protections which he got here in federal court in Boston and what the I would say the typical death penalty defendant gets in America.
In federal cases or in state cases?
I think in federal cases they're relatively uniform because it's a more uniform system.
But the disparities at the state level.
I mean, the disparities are probably less than they were if we're talking about the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, but they still exist.
All right. Well, David Boeri, we have less than a minute left. I understand you're back on the line. I want to get a final thought from you just to sort of wrap this up for us today.
Anthony, again, I just go to my observation today.
In this courtroom, death was hanging from four corners. The ceilings were low, and it was hard to breathe. And we were back to where we were once before in this trial, and you just get the sense. Somebody made the comment about victim impact statements and what had happened. She likened this to a dandelion that's gone to seed. With the wind at your back, you blow it. And how do you pull it all back to describe what happened to you? And it's like this case in so many ways. Profound effects, years of surgery, people financially broken, heartbroken, lost, their lives turned asunder. And you just get a sense of the unspeakable sadness of so much that has happened. And even to the defendant, you look at this person that was described as this bright new American, and you see him and what happened and the evil that happened here. And you look at it, it is this great, great tragedy. It goes forward. The justice system is hard-pressed to see this to an end. We as a country have to deal with it. It is a profoundly disturbing problem.
Well, David Boeri, WBUR senior reporter, thank you. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for all your hard work on this case.
And Donald.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. And Donald Stern, former U.S. attorney and now managing partner with Affiliated Monitors. Thank you so much for being with us.
And David Hoos, Northampton defense attorney. He joined us from New England Public Radio in Springfield. David Hoos, thank you for your thoughtfulness as well.
I'm glad to participate.
And that wraps up our special coverage of the sentencing hearing of Jahar Tsarnaev. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.